It's good to see everybody. We're coming to a conclusion in the book of Judges, of the judges that we have been studying. And of course, now we're studying the life of Samson. And over the next two sermons, as we come to the conclusion in the life of Samson, we're also taking off again. And we're going to go into a, Lord willing, and the Spirit continues to impress me this way, we're going into a multi-week study on the concept of marriage. Now, if you're currently married, I hope it'll be a blessing to you. If you're thinking about getting married, I know it'll be a blessing to you. If you're old and married, I think it'll be a blessing to you. I mean, here's the problem. We're all totally depraved sinners and we all have issues, and you never grow out of your issues. You grow in Jesus Christ, but we still have issues. And so, Lord willing, we're going to use as our kind of thematic verse over the next several weeks, we're going to use this passage in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 31. It's one of the most quoted verses when it comes to marriage. You hear it in marriage ceremonies a lot, and I hope we can unpack it a little bit more over the next several weeks. So for today, I'll read this one, and then we'll go to Samson, because the two actually tie in together well with the last two chapters of Samson's life. Speaking about marriage, this is what the Apostle Paul writes to the church of Ephesus. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. A lot to be said for leaving mom and daddy and joining unto your wife. There's a lot of need for that, an understanding of exactly what that means today. Divorce within the Christian church is at equal levels of the secular world, and that's a travesty and a shame because it impedes our testimony. And there's a reason for it, and it's because secular ideas are really getting into today's world, in today's church, into Christian thought processes, and it's really poisoning in us. And I say that because we're living in a society now, and this is no great sociological study needs to demonstrate this, but it's really kind of a me generation. And you hear some of the, let me put this in a spiritual language, really stupid ideas about what makes a good spouse and what's making a good spouse. You know, various studies, and I've been reading through this, just the shallowness of our culture. And I got to be honest with you, too. I recognize some of these shallow ideas in my own head. You know, you look at a young man, why exactly are you getting married to this woman? I mean, and typically, one of the top three answers of a young man is going to be based on her physicality, right? And then we had this silly romantic concept of, well, he just completes me, you know, we finish each other's sentences. You know, I've been married 22 years, we finish each other's sentences. I mean, Maria, would you make
your own sandwich?
We're finishing each other's sentences. But for those of y'all that are thinking about getting married, that are young kids, that are going to be getting married, I want to assure you one thing. There is no perfect soulmate out there. The only perfect person that ever walked this earth was Jesus Christ. And if you are looking for a man or a woman to fulfill you and make your life complete, you will be sorely disappointed. And for anybody that's been married for more than 2 weeks, you all know that the Hollywood idealized they lived happily ever after is just that. It's fantasy. Because marriage is work. Marriage is sacrifice. Marriage is surrender. And marriage is also subjecting your personality so that the two become one flesh. And the Apostle Paul refers to this process as a great mystery. And I can totally identify with it. I haven't always been able to identify with it. But, you know, when I got married, just a, you know, way of personal example before we dive right into Samson, because you're going to see that he does not do well at this either. Before I got married, we're picking out China patterns, right? Maria wants my input. So we go to Macy's, we go into the China department, we're looking at all these beautiful little China patterns. And we take time with the little flowers and trims and things, and she says, well, what would you like, John? And she looks at me with those gorgeous blue eyes. And I said, I think we ought to get pewter, you know? Durable, never will break, can be thrown at each other. You know, it's all good stuff. And the look of disappointment. And you know, it was kind of a mystery to me. I didn't understand it because I'm coming from this area of, you know, practicality, that we can deed them to our children and our grandchildren. And she's coming it from, she wants to make a beautiful home. Totally foreign concept to me. Mystery. There's a lot of mystery surrounding marriages. So over the next 5 to 6, maybe 7 weeks, we're going to unpack that mystery of marriage. Well, let's turn to somebody who we've been kind of tied into, and we've been studying him for the last several weeks, and a guy by the name of Samson. We're coming to chapter 15 of Samson. To understand chapter 15, let's remember where the last chapter ended. Samson had been engaged. He's going to he's going down. He's about to engage into this wedding ceremony, but he starts having this drinking party with the Philistines, and he gives them a riddle because Samson had already broken his Nazarite vow, how he had killed the lion. And then a couple of days later, he's walking by. There's a swarm of honeybees in him, and he gives this big old riddle, kind of making a joke about his lack of holiness. You know, out of the eater, something sweet. And he makes kind of a big joke about it. Because people that are ungodly are very comfortable joking around about godly things, being disrespectful about it. Anyway, so what happens is he says, look, if you people can solve this riddle, I'll give each one of you a brand new suit, new garment. And if you don't, then you got to give me something. And they go to his intended fiance and they say, hey, look, if you don't get us the thing to do, we're going to punish you and his family. Well, he finds on out that they had done this when it comes time to settle the riddle, right before the wedding ceremony. The invitations have been sent out. All the invites have been done. He's about to go into the ceremony. It's time to fess up. And so the Philistines are able to answer his riddle. And he said, had you not plowed with my heifer, you would not have known the answer. Okay, clue number one to marriage. Never refer to your wife as a heifer. Just, I'm just saying that. Then Samson does something that kind of puts a damper on any wedding party. He kills all 30 members of the wedding party. And then he stomps home to mama. So, what happens is that his future father-in-law says to his little girl, who had picked out the wedding dress, they had already gotten all the arrangements together, had gone a tremendous amount of effort, and says, okay, baby, you can have one of the groomsmen. And so the wife and the groomsmen get married. And Samson comes on back. And Samson comes back, and I want to just kind of, just so we can get the full flavor of it, and I'm not trying to be funny, but there's so much humor in this, it's just like, what were you thinking? And he says, here's how, I mean, and I want to know the process of Samson's thought process. So he says, I'm going to go, and I'm going to make up with my wife, so what should I do? Well, let me go get this baby goat. Oh yeah, that makes up for killing 30 people in the groom's part, you know. That makes up for, you know, the slaughter of 30 people, for calling the wife heifer. I mean, this would be akin to having a major blow up, calling your wife all kinds of names, and then bringing her a daisy that you picked up on the side of the road saying, sorry. So he comes on up to the house and he says, I want to be with my wife, which is kind of a highly disrespectful term if you understand what I'm saying. The father-in-law is like, well, I'm so sorry. But I've already given her away to one of the groomsmen. Samson loses his temper. And so what he does is he gets 30 foxes and he ties a firebrand to their tails. He joins together five ties firebrands to the tail and they go running on out. And there's just this massive fire that destroys a lot of crops. Philistines get really, really mad. And as a result of Samson's unrestrained anger, they killed the father-in-law and they killed his once intended bride. Just tragedy surrounding Samson at every turn. Bad decisions left and right. Bad decisions for the marriage. Bad decisions for the community. But they all stem from Samson's own poor choices. Interesting passage here too. When Samson had done what he had done, Samson said, and this is in verse 3, it said, Samson said concerning them, now I shall be more blameless than the Philistines, though I do them a displeasure. And then there's a second passage just further on down where Samson intends to justify his anger. So today as we study in the life of Samson and try to extrapolate what the Lord wants us to extrapolate, one of the things that we're going to extrapolate from today is how do we deal with anger? How do we deal with anger in our marriages? How do we deal with anger in our personal relationships? How can we deal with anger so that we're just not this massive, destructive force of evil out there in the world? Anger is one of those things which Jesus has an awful lot to talk about. As a matter of fact, one of the seminal passages in the Bible concerning this topic, Jesus spoke himself, and it's Matthew chapter 18. Because I want you to know something. In marriages, whether it's your fiancé or whether it's your bride or wherever it is, because we're going to see when Samson actually does get married, he's never going to actually fix this issue of anger. Because anger sometimes can be just outward explosion, you vent on somebody else, but sometimes anger can be kind of passive. Both of those are very destructive. Because when it comes to anger, I want you to imagine this. The Bible says, be angry and sin not. Anger is not necessarily an evil emotion in and of itself. Per se, anger is not a sin. The sin is reacting inappropriately to anger. Anger is more like a fire alarm that won't shut up. It's designed to help you to move into action. If you see a little child being picked on in the schoolyard, you can get mad at the bully. It's anger that's causing you to move towards justice. Sometimes anger is causing you to fix a problem because you're hurt, you're scared, something's going on. But anger is designed. It's like that fire alarm. There's a fire. Sometimes the fire alarm goes off not because there's an actual smoke, it's because the batteries are low. Y'all have all had this experience, right? The batteries in your house or in the fire alarm are actually low, so the fire alarm's just chirping and it won't shut up, and it's always at 2 o'clock in the morning. And that's designed what? Designed to get you up and fix the batteries. Sometimes the anger is not motivating us to external action. Sometimes the anger needs to motivate us to internal action so that we can fix it and what's on the inside. Well, this is what the Lord says, and it's found in Matthew chapter 18. And I'm just thinking along the way if Samson had ever done any of these things. Matthew chapter 18, verse 15. Because there is no greater challenges to building a community than to master the art of handling anger and conflict. I got to tell you, this weekend meeting with Brother Hobgoss and Brother Brantley was just so special to me because we got to host those two men in our house, and we stayed up till midnight one of the nights, and we were just talking. And as a pastor, there's those that can identify with this. You just kind of sit back and you can feel the spirit is moving in a particular direction, and you don't know where the adventure is going to take you, but like the winds come up and the cells start to flutter, it's one of those moments for me in my pastorship. And because there's so many confluences of events that are transpiring right now, and it's kind of in this realm, and I'll just give you kind of a heads up on it. Brother Dickey had mentioned that he'd been to a conference out in Dallas on how to be a better counselor as a pastor. And Brother Brantley had mentioned, well, yeah, I went to that same one, but it was in San Francisco, San Diego, about 4 or 5 years ago. And in my own life, I've had so many challenges. The first 5 months of this year is more challenging than any other time in my pastorship. And the thought was, and the thought that was put on the table was this. There is biblical precedent that counseling doesn't belong to the ministry. The counseling belongs to the congregation as well. Sure, we have our roles, but y'all do too. Do y'all realize that as the hands and feet of Jesus Christ, that where you go and what you say has an impact on other people? Let me be very clear. Because I don't get to hang out at your work. I'm not inside your bedroom. I'm not out with your friends on dinner night. Y'all are. And the conversations that y'all have and the words that you use are either going to have a positive or a negative effect on the hearer. Very few words are ever just plain neutral. And so when your friends will say to you, "No, I'm having struggles in my marriage. I've just lost a mama. My son's a pain in the neck." The next words that come out of your mouth will have a counseling effect. "I just lost my baby at 3 months in the womb. Suffered a miscarriage." The words that come out of your mouth next will have a positive or negative effect. And so the conversations that were around the dinner table, or around the table that evening, it was kind of centered around, How can not only we, but how can we also equip our congregations to know where to go to in the Bible, what words to say, what thoughts, so that they can help other people experience the freedom and the joy and the relief that is in Jesus Christ. And I hope to go on this experiment with you for the next however long the Spirit leads us in this regard. And when I was thinking about it, and that's why it's kind of in the realm of marriage, is because that, I think, is just such a great need among us in our society right now. Well, Jesus has these words right now. And so every one of you has friends or has someone who needs counseling on anger management or how and what to do when they get mad. So every one of you, if your minds are drifting, if you will give it back for just a minute, just the next few minutes, if you will give it back, take notes, do whatever you want to, burn this passage in your brain. But next time that y'all are around a dinner table, around a coffee shop, at a video arcade, and you experience somebody and you're talking with them about somebody or some issue that's making them upset, this passage is the passage for which you are to counsel them on. It's Matthew chapter 18, verse 15. These are the words of the Lord. And this is such an issue in our day. FBI statistics most recently released says there is a violent crime every 23 seconds, an aggravated assault every 28 seconds, a murder every 43 minutes. More women died of domestic violence in the Vietnam War than soldiers on the battlefield. Anger is an issue. It's ripping apart our marriages. It destroys friendships. It rips apart churches. It's horrendous. And, you know, there are a lot of churches where the sins that really get people in trouble revolve around lifestyle issues. Sneaking a cigarette, having a beer, going to the wrong movie, listening to the wrong kind of music. And even today you hear pastors being fired for, you know, moral reasons. But you never really hear about churches dismissing people for anger. And the fact of the matter is we ought to be kind of scandalized by anger. Because Jesus is, because love was his supreme value. His summation of the total teaching of divine revelation is captured in a single word, love. Love for God, love for his people. And as a matter of fact, he prayed in John chapter 17, "As thou, Father, art in me and I in thee, that they may also be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me." He prayed for oneness. And when we violate oneness, when we contribute to relational brokenness, it just doesn't affect us and it just doesn't affect the other person. We are contributing to the destruction most prized by God and purchased by him at greatest cost. This is the prayer of Jesus. As a matter of fact, the Apostle Paul, he wrote to the church of Corinth in 1 Corinthians 3:3, he says, "Ye are yet carnal, for whereas there is among you envying and strife and divisions, are ye not carnal and walk as men?" Where anger exists, it's an evidence of carnality. And really, there's been identified two main causes of anger, too. There's the stupid, inanimate object anger, where I get mad at the ATM that doesn't give me my cash. I get angry at the shoestring that breaks. The worst case of it, I read up in Bellevue, Washington, where this guy gets mad because his car won't start on a very cold winter day, so he gets a tire iron out. And he beats in the windshield, then he literally gets a gun out and shoots the engine. It's the first case of autocide that I've ever read about. That's a stupid, inanimate object. But the main target of our anger is other people. One study I looked at not too long ago asked the question of children, how do you wish your mom was different? 98% responded first, "I wish she wouldn't yell at me so much." Stress causes anger. All kinds of things causes anger. So I want to structure the rest of the sermon around a single statement of Jesus. Matthew chapter 18, verse 15. "Moreover, if thy brethren shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. And if he shall hear thee, thou hast gained a brother." This statement, future counselors, Camp Creek Church, can be broken down into seven stages. And every seventh stage is intricately connected to another one. If there is a conflict, if you go to that person in private, directly communicate for the purpose of reconciliation. Those are the seven stages. Dealing with conflict is always a series of choices. Samson, if you look back at Samson 15 that we just read about, Samson had a whole bunch of choices. When you mess up, and when you mess up really bad, when you leave your bride at the altar, you don't have some lame makeup gift. Flowers, husbands, little free marital advice here. Flowers don't make up for everything. Sometimes it's going to take a lot more pittance than that. So let's break it down. And you know the weird thing about this statement of Jesus? If your brother should trespass against thee, go. This is perhaps the most violated instruction that Jesus Christ has ever given the human race. Bar none. Bar none. Because at each point you can get off the path. There are seven stages here, and we have seven decisions, and at each point we can get off the path. And we face powerful reasons to ignore his instructions. We're tempted to go the other way. So let's just kind of walk through them. That first clausal phrase, if your brother sins against you. The text says if. But in all honesty, we could probably replace that text with the word when. When your brother, because we live in an as-is universe. We are totally depraved sinners. There's not one among us who's not depraved. We all have issues. So when your brother trespasses against you. And so one of the steps is to honestly admitting that there's conflict in your life, that there's been a breakdown. Some relationships that were once significant have deteriorated to such a point that you need to take some action. The alarm is going off. And the truth about conflict, it's often complex and hard to resolve, even with goodwill. But we got to be committed to it and look squarely in the eye of the other person. So if or when your brother trespasses against you, you go to the other person. The next word Jesus says right here is you. And he calls everyone who will listen to own the task of seeking reconciliation. And we just don't want to do it if we're going to be honest with each other. It is so much easier to call and talk to somebody else about how sister so-and-so or brother so-and-so has offended you. Just, you know. I remember watching a television documentary not that long ago where one man felt that the other driver had cut him off. He tailgated and pulled along the other driver. They made an angry gesture at him, so he pulls out a gun and he kills her. It's a 17-year-old girl that he just did that to. And the man's statement was, well, I'm just as much a victim as she is. Seriously? Seriously. So the first thing is just owning responsibility that the burden is on you. As a matter of fact, Jesus says in this passage, if a brother trespass against you. In another passage, he says, if you trespass against somebody else, you. So whether you're the offender or the offendee, the burden is on you. It's never on the other person. You cannot sit back. You are not justified. Listen to me. You are not justified in sitting back and saying, well, they can come and apologize to me. Hades is going to freeze over before I ever get to respond to them. If you've said those words, if you have those feelings, you are sinning. You go. Don't play the games of justifying your mismanaged anger because of what somebody else has done. Whether you're the offender or the offendee, the burden is on you. And Jesus says simply, go. Take action. Don't let resentment fester. But, you know, in all honesty, I don't want to go. It feels so much better sometimes just to stew in my anger, to rehearse all the things and how I've been victimized. But going is a huge step. And Jesus doesn't even give us parameters. I mean, he doesn't even say, try to do it well or anything. But one of the things that Jesus is saying by saying go is he's saying don't avoid, because avoidance kills communities. Avoidance kills churches. Avoidance kills relationships. Avoidance causes resentment to fester inside of you. And, you know, anger is a physiological it's a physiological arousal. The more adrenaline is created, more sugar is dumped into your heart beats faster, your pupils will dilate, your blood pressure rises. In anger, there's something very powerful about anger. It can make you feel very powerful. You can almost get addicted to it. But some people don't grow up where they just let it out. Some people grow up in homes where they learn to stuff it. Some people have this idea, I should go around and I should never experience anger. And if I experience anger, it means I'm a horrible, horrible person. And it's a good thing to have the capacity to be angry. It's like that emergency alarm. It's designed to help you get off and go do something. But avoidance isn't one of them. That's why Jesus doesn't give you the option of avoidance. He says, go. Go. Book of Proverbs, writer of Proverbs, he says this. A wise man feareth and departeth from evil, but the fool rageth and is confident. We may want to physically leave a situation and go somewhere until our emotions are out of the red zone, and that's a good idea. But sometimes cooling off period will not work if you use that time period to pursue anger-inducing thoughts, rehearsing anger. You got to find a way to reroute your thoughts. There's actually a couple of ways to reroute your thoughts too. And I'm sharing this with you because I experience this. When you get angry, instead of delaying, instead of avoiding, instead of stewing and festering and letting it all build up inside of you, you got to reroute it. Jesus addressed this topic of anger. And we can see through the Bible so much anger and so much destruction, and that's not God's plan in the world. Let me ask you a question real quick. How many of y'all want to go to heaven? Pretty much everybody, right? How many of you want to go to heaven right now? A little ambiguity there. I mean, we're in church. We know we're supposed to say, yeah, but, you know. I mean, I remember being 12, 13, 14, I wanted to get married. Just like, yeah, hold off the whole heaven thing. You know, I want to go there, but, you know, maybe I could, you know, at least drive a car first. Let me ask you another question. How many of y'all would like to live in a world where there were no birth defects? No bellies swollen because of starvation? No divorce? No anger, no hatred, no malice, no sadness, no death, no disease, no suffering. That was God's plan. A perfectly redeemed world. And we messed it up. And that day of redemption is coming. But God says to his family, he says to his children, he says that you can be a part of bringing that heavenly state to this earth right now. So where there is disease, where there is heartache, where there is struggle, where there is divorce, where there are addictions, where there is pain, where there is heartache, if you follow God's plan, you can be part of the corrective force for redemption that God has in the person of Jesus Christ. So why are we talking about anger? This is one of these destructive forces that you can be a part of redeeming because you are the hands and feet of Christ. Jesus says, you know, when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was in prison, you visited me. He was talking to us. Don't take that lightly. And so Jesus says, don't avoid. Go. And it's a scary thing to go sometimes because you got to look at the person that made you mad. And sometimes it's a delightful thing to go if you do it, you know, correctly. Jesus says go, but he doesn't stop right there because Jesus says something else. And when you go, make sure you reroute your thoughts. And one of the ways I have found of rerouting our thoughts is ask a couple of questions. First off is, why am I angry? Because, you know, anger is not one of the primary emotions. You know, we have primary colors like red, yellow, and blue. And from those colors, all other colors can come together. But anger is not like one of the primary emotions. And typically when I ask myself, I'm not the Hulk. I'm not constantly angry. But when I ask myself, why am I angry? Typically, I can find it out. I mean, let's just say for some example that I happened to ask out a very attractive redheaded woman when I was a young man. And she said, you know, I don't think so. I don't find you particularly attractive, and I think you're somewhat boring. The anger that would have welled up in me would have been based on hurt or pride. In a similar way, let's say that this particular redheaded woman warmed up to me, and I'm about to pick her up for her first date, and I get pulled over for going too fast, and I'm running behind, and I'm getting all angry. What's that based out of? Frustration. Right? Or another scenario, things work really well. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. There is a noise downstairs and she wakes you up and she says, do you hear that noise? There's something going on downstairs. And I'm like, what noise? She says, no, I heard something downstairs. Go down there and see what it is. And I'm like, oh, no, I don't really want to do that. Look, I just heard about this guy that escaped from the hospital for the criminally insane psychopathic ward. He was a homicidal maniac killer that's been put away and he escaped. And it's just down the road. I want you to go downstairs and check it out. My anger is based on what? Fear. I mean, yeah, here I go in my BVDs. Woo, that's going to scare him. All right, here we go. But, you know, anger, typically when you ask yourself why you're angry, it's going to be based on hurt, it's going to be based on fear, it's going to be based on frustration. There's going to be an underlying issue, and it can help guide you towards actually resolving that issue. The next thing that you should ask yourself when you're attempting to reroute your thoughts, if you need to reroute your thoughts, because sometimes we do, is what exactly do I want when I go? To resolve this anger, what do I want? And if your desire is to win the argument, do not go. If your desire is to win the argument, to score more points, to zing it back and hurt them just like they hurt you, do not do it. Instead of, because I tell you, when we get angry, we start thinking about what we can say to win the argument. And then instead of listening, all we're doing is taking time to reload the gun. Inappropriate way to deal with anger. One of the techniques I like to use when I'm talking to people about anger is using the baton method. And literally, it's very quite simple, and I encourage anybody. You can use a baton, you can use a book, you can use a crayon for all I care. But when you're trying to talk it out, the person with the crayon is the only person that gets to speak, no matter how bad you want to, no matter how many times you just go, I got the crayon, you know. And then when you're done, you turn the crayon over, and then it's your turn. You know, the other person gets to talk. And that way you have to listen. But I found when I was early on in the ministry is that didn't particularly work. Because you're sitting there going, and all you're doing is just loading up your little gun and how you're going to respond as soon as you get that crayon back. So the next technique that we do, and this is a whole lot more successful, is you pass the crayon and the person that gets the crayon, the baton, the piece of glass, whatever it is, they say, this is what I just heard you say. You know. Yeah. Maria. John, you really want to wear that shirt with that tie? Well, this is what I just heard you say. You called me ugly with bad taste. No, I didn't say that at all, you know. But seriously, if y'all are involved in conflict, or y'all got a relational issue like that, take the time, number one, not to say anything, but number two, one of the best things I've ever found out in relationship counseling is to repeat back to the other person what you heard them say, and I promise you, 9 times out of 10, you heard it wrong, and they didn't mean that, and it helped you get back on page a lot quicker. So, you go. And if you've got to reroute your thoughts, one of the ways you can reroute your thoughts is just take some proactive steps to do that. Because let me tell you something. Certain thoughts, and this is no rocket science, certain thoughts tend to lead to anger. People who have trouble managing anger are people who are habitually thinking hostile, cynical thoughts about other people. I mean, your mindset is so important. I think I shared this with you a couple of years back. Joshua used to have a bedtime, Josh and Caleb used to have a bedtime of 9 o'clock. And there are days back in the day when at night, 9:30, I'll be sitting down and I'll just be relaxing. Everything's hunky-dory. The cotton's high. Mama's good-looking. Everything's great. And he'll come sneaking downstairs and I'll be thinking, oh, what a little tyke, so cute. These are Kodak moments and I'm just not going to have much time like this left. I just love on him, pat him on the bottom, say, go on back to bed. But then there's other days. He comes on downstairs. I'm still working on my message because it's just not coming. And his 9:30 and thoughts like, what is wrong with this child? Why is he so irretractably disobedient? What kind of homicidal maniac am I raising here? And why did he get so much of his mama's DNA? Two different, same parents, same kids, same situation, two entirely different thought processes, you see? Because of the way that I'm allowing my mind to go. Brothers and sisters in Christ, one of the ways to help us deal with the anger issues is to take a moment to reroute our thoughts. Samson did not have to kill 30 people. He didn't have to destroy a wedding party. He could have thought about the fact, my father-in-law sent out all the invitations, went to great expenses. His little girl was bawling. Maybe I did something wrong. Had all kinds of choices. At every stage he had choices and he didn't take it. The Apostle Paul writes to us in the book of Philippians, he says in 4:8, he says, finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any praise, think on these things. One research team in the trucking company was trying to teach their drivers how not to get angry when they're behind the wheel, and the most effective technique that they taught the drivers was that they say, next time somebody cuts you off in traffic, next time somebody's going too slow, I want you to think, there goes mama. It started working. Their incidents of driver-related complaints and accidents actually fell dramatically. Train your thoughts, train your thoughts, train your thoughts. If your brother offends, you go to them, directly to the person involved. Directly to the person involved, not to third people, not to third parties to be talking about it. It's kind of cool because we tend to think of the first century church as kind of a conflict-free environment, as kind of this paradise of the church, the good old days of the church, the first century church, man, they did it all right. But this is the same New Testament that tells us how people were of one mind, one accord, devoted themselves to each other. It paints this picture of a community that was in conflict. The Greek-speaking members of the church had a big ruckus with the Hebrew-speaking members of the church over how the widows were taken care of. Ananias and Sapphira were so jealous of each other's reputation for generosity that they severely damaged their health. Paul and Barnabas had such a strong disagreement over a colleague that they dissolved their partnership. The early church was fraught with conflict. But it was a place where people were accountable and committed to managing their conflict as well. I beg you, if I ever offend you or step on your toes, please come directly to me. Don't stop coming to church. That's just brain dead. That's not going to do you any good. You're not hurting anybody but yourself. And I promise you, I will listen to you in love. Apostle Paul wrote to this community at Philippi where there were two prominent women, Euodias and Syntyche. And they were locked in a difficult conflict. And we don't know what the issue was. Maybe it was who had the more weird name. I mean, who names a child Euodias? Anyway, they had this whole difficult conflict. And Euodias, I can imagine if it had happened today, Euodias going to three or four of her closest friends saying, we just need to pray for Syntyche. She is such a raving lunatic. No. And the Apostle Paul, when he was dealing with it, he says, he strongly asks it. As a matter of fact, he uses the term, I beseech you, and then to resolve this conflict directly that they can be of the same mine. And he says that they have labored with him in the gospel. One of the strongest commendations that he give. And then he says that their names are in the book of life. The difficulties with conflict do not diminish their standing in Paul's eyes at all. The fact that they engage in conflict doesn't make them any lesser children of God. Because the litmus test of spirituality is not the absence of conflict. Conflict happens to Christians. The litmus test of spirituality is how you handle your conflict, how you handle your anger. One of the great myths of our day is that you can talk anger out, that people will become less angry. Talking out an emotion does not diminish it. It rehearses it. So let's get rid of that one. So you go to them, not to a third party, and you go to them with absolute clarity and talk to them about it. You know, talking about conflict, it's the height of irony that few organizations have often or split more bitterly than the church. In the 20th century, there are more than 100 varieties of Baptist churches alone. We have the Southern Baptist, we have the Northern Baptist, we have the General Baptist, we have the Particular Baptist, we have Seventh-day Baptist, we have Free Will Baptist, we have Hartshill Baptist, we have the Duck River and Kindred Association Baptist, and my favorite one is the Two-Seed in the Spirit Predestination Baptist. There are 30,000, there are 30,000 Christian denominations. There is one church that calls itself the True Church of God. It was called the Church of God. A faction split off, calling themselves the True Church of God, and then that church split, and you have one called the Only True Church of God. I'm serious. Reminds me of a joke of a man that was deserted on an island, and when the rescuers come to pick him up, he's taking him on a tour, and he goes, well, this is the hut that I lived in, and that was my kitchen that I built away from the hut, and that's my church. And they go, well, what's that other building? He says, that's the church I used to go to. Jesus says that we are to approach the object of our anger in private. Deal with it just between the two of you. And one of the consequences of that strategy is we don't need to needlessly embarrass another person, forcing them to respond in front of other people. And the need for sensitivity is one of the most important and often one of the most misunderstood aspects of healthy anger management. Because another myth is that the best way to handle anger is to ventilate it. Get it off your chest. Let it all hang out. Let the steam come out. Throw something. Hit something. Scream something. And according to this theory, if we don't let it out, if it doesn't fly away, if it does build up like steam, then like a tea kettle, someday if we don't release it, it's just going to blow up. You know, I don't know why we isolate anger that way. Nobody talks about joy that way. Oh, I'm just so joyful that if I don't let it out, I'm just going to explode with joy. People don't say get in touch with your gratitude. Your parents help you, sacrifice for you, yet you never really verbalize your thankfulness. Now you got all this gratitude built up inside of you. It's not healthy. You're a walking time bomb of gratitude. Somebody's going to walk around, you're just going to explode on them one day. Ventilation is tolerable, but it's also self-reinforcing. And there's another problem with ventilation. People don't like getting ventilated on. How often do you see this scene? One man feels like he's been cut off by another motorist. He pulls alongside the perpetrator and he says, "What kind of idiot are you? What were you thinking? Were you trying to kill me?" And the other person says, "Well taken. I'm glad." Good point. I'm glad you said that to me. Thank you. I'm gonna change. And Jesus says, seriously, the simplest guideline is to approach the other person the way that you want to be approached. Go to that person directly in private and tell him. Show him his fault, Jesus says. And that is often so much easier said than done. Very often when faced with face-to-face confrontation, people end up addressing the problem indirectly in an effort to soften the blow. For example, a wife that might be frustrated with her husband helping around the house would say something to the effect of, "Wouldn't you like to see a clean house today?" To which he thinks, "Well, No, not really. I'm tired. And I think we talked about this particular aspect of this years ago, in that really, you got to go the final 10%. You can talk 90%, but you can avoid the really, really direct issues. And if you don't go the final 10% all the way, then really you haven't accomplished what Jesus talks about. Because Jesus says you got to be completely candid. And finally, for the purpose of reconciliation. If he listens to you, Jesus says, you have won a brother over. And the goal in conflict situations is not to win. It's not to score a point. It is reconciliation. Your aim should be to restore the relationship. Reconciliation is rarely simple. It's almost never easy. But Jesus says, it's what we're supposed to do. And it's his will for his children. And it's his express command for his church. And if that's not the goal of going and talking to other people, then everything else that we do is going to be for naught. It's going to be for nothing. I was trying to parallel park in a congested area one time, coming to a conclusion of the sermon. But I want to make a point on this point, because going to people for the purpose of reconciliation is the end-all, be-all of what we're talking about here. I was trying to parallel park in a particularly congested area. And the man behind me was getting exceptionally frustrated. And right as I was getting on in, he wheels up beside me, literally rolls down the window, and he refers to me in an anatomical part that's south of the equator. Okay, now, step one. If your brother trespasses against you, you go to him, communicate with them in private. This man aces. I mean, step one, there was a conflict. He went to me directly in private, and he went the final 10%. There was no doubt about how he felt about me individually and my worth in humanity in general. There was no doubt. Man had gone the final 10%. And he asked me, what kind of idiot are you? Profound question. But his point was, and his point was not to make reconciliation, because he drove off. If you do the first six steps, you haven't done it. You got to go the distance. You got to do it for the point of reconciliation. And if it's not for reconciliation, it's a waste of time, and a lot of times you're just going to make the matter worse. At every single point, as y'all counsel other people, your friends, your family members, you counsel each other, these steps have to be followed in sequence. They have to be followed in order. The Lord knew what he was doing. Surprise, the omniscient force of the universe that knows all and can create universes with just the snap of his finger, with just the word of his mouth. He knew what he was talking about. And these are the steps that we're supposed to do it in. Or else we could be like Samson. Destroy people, destroy property, and come to the ruin of, and have a life that is just in shambles at the end of it, missing out on many of the blessings that God has for us. Now, I want to give you one last word, too. Because there's going to be times when you do all seven steps, and you do all seven steps perfectly, and it still will not work. What do you do then? And God has one more gift for you. And it's called forgiveness. And it's what Jesus did for you. Not because of how good you are, not because you went through the seven steps, not because of anything you said, anything you did, any way you acted. It's simply because we serve a God who is full of grace. He's full of love. He is passionate for you. And he has a plan for your life. Are you benefiting from God's plan for your life to the maximum ability that you can? Following his steps. Doing the things that he says to do. Because if you do, I can promise you, you will be a part of a redemptive force that is here to transform the world for his blessings. One of the things he asks you to do, he says, if you haven't taken up your cross, I'd like you to take up your cross and follow me. That's what Jesus says. It will be the best decision of your life.